You're listening to Pastor Bill Surjack at Montreat Conference Center, sharing perspectives on C.S. Lewis's Doctrine of Evil. This is Sermon Gold.
Kara means joy. That was a word we used in the Surprised by Joy, the title of Lewis's biography or his oratory of his Christian journey. The Greek word is kara, and it's really kind of a central word in the Christian faith because the word means joy. And the word charis means surprising joy. Or you can add a few other things to it, like you, an EU in front of it, like a euphony is a good sound. And so this is good surprising joy is Eucharist. So the communion comes from that too. And also it's the root of the word charismata or charismatic. So good surprising gift. It's kind of neat that all of that Christian theology is centered around the Greek word joy. And so Lewis says he likes to play with words all the time. When he wrote his title for his coming to faith in Christ, he called it Surprised by Joy. You know, since he later married Joy Davidman, some people confuse it that he must have been talking about his wife Joy, but it's he was playing with words. He likes to play with words a lot, so every once in a while you'll pick up some of that. In this, we talked about earlier, W.T. Kirkpatrick, his tutor, was very insistent on getting the right words and using the right words. And he would just grill Lewis until he got the right word for the right instance. One of the things that you'll find in reading Lewis is his use of words. It's incredible. Even in his letters, when he's writing a letter to somebody, he uses just beautiful sentences and in it, the expressions, he'll seem to pick out just the right word. And that's a real gift in Lewis. Actually, it's a worked on gift. Now that I have email, I probably write more letters than I ever used to before. And I try to work to write better. And I'm probably one of those people who I'm kind of telephone shy. So I don't like to call people on the telephone. I love email because I feel like I'm not interrupting anybody. They can pick it up when they're ready, and I have a chance to collect my thoughts before I write it down. Right now, I email two people in Colorado regularly, a friend in Chicago, a friend in Zagreb, Croatia, and two friends in Chattanooga, my sister and her husband in Pennsylvania, another person in Pennsylvania. It's almost once a week, so I spend a lot of time in front of my computer screen these days. A friend of mine says I seem to be developing a cyber ministry of some sort there. So. But I do like to use email. Lewis wrote all of his stuff longhand. He wrote out all of his letters that he's written, that they've been published in books, start off longhand. All the books that he wrote them all longhand. So that was before the age of computers, and he didn't even seem to like to use a typewriter. So that's the way he did his expressions. And Lewis, like I said, he was very fussy on words. Interesting quote from Lewis is that he said, "Tell me what the hard words mean. You've done me more good than 1,000 commentaries." And that tends to be the way Lewis interprets things. He tries to understand what the words mean. Like I said before, we're used to reading theology in the church, and we tend to read in suppositions, one statement after another that kind of build on each other. And Lewis tends to see things in pictures. And so sometimes people who are used to reading church people have a hard time with Lewis because he doesn't write the way most church people write. And so we have a little trouble getting into that. So he'll picture things like the book that I said about from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where they were describing Aslan. But Lucy found out that he was a lion, and she wasn't sure that she wanted to meet a lion. She was maybe afraid of meeting a lion. And she said, "Is he quite safe? Is he tame?" Mrs. Beaver said, "Oh, no, he's not tame at all. He's a wild lion, but he's good." Now, that's a wonderful picture of what God's like, that he's not tame. We can't train God to jump through hoops for us, but he's good. He will respond in a way that is good. You could probably try to build a theological statements or ideas to describe that. But Lewis describes it in that one little phrase, kind of giving a picture. And that's the way he'll tend to do things. And also what words mean are very important to him. And I increasingly found that helpful for me in interpreting scripture. Just learn what the words mean. Just that one word there where we talked about the little word joy, how much one little word means. And how much meaning that carries in all through the Christian faith. And so find out what the words mean. Usually the first thing that I do when I start working on a passage of scripture that I'm going to preach on it is try to define the words. And Lewis was very good at defining words. I want to hand out from the last time was just kind of a biography of Lewis, where some of the major things that happened when he wrote his books, some of the things that happened in them. One thing that might be of some question on that biography, if you haven't seen it before, is there's one thing about a trip to Whipsnade Zoo, which seems an unusual thing that a significant event would be a trip to a zoo. But that's where Lewis put everything together, and he became a Christian on that trip. He said when he started the trip, he didn't believe that Jesus was God, and when he ended the trip, he did. And nothing particularly happened on the trip, and he wasn't even thinking that much, but it came together for him on that trip. Like I was saying, Lewis tends to work with pictures, the tame lion picture of what God is like, that he's not a tame lion, that he's a wild lion, but he's good. And we'll read some more of the pictures that you begin to see theology that way. And we're not used to doing theology that way. We're used to doing it in statement form. Even you can tell that Andrew Purvis is pretty much of a statement kind of a theologian. And theologians a lot of times just don't like Lewis that well because he doesn't speak their language. He speaks a little different language. He speaks a literary language. It's kind of a shame that he knew T.S. Eliot, but he never knew Karl Barth, or they never wrote back and forth. It would have been interesting had they been able to carry on some kind of a conversation. Lewis might have been more of a theological writer, and Barton may have been more of a visual writer at that point. I don't know. Or maybe God intended to keep them in their own places. But tonight, this lesson is a little bit about the way Lewis sees evil. He sees evil a little different than the way people tend to see evil, even in today's world. I don't know if you've seen any political ads on TV recently. I don't know if you've been able to avoid seeing political ads on TV recently. But it's amazing how we've kind of gotten down to the basic thing that an ad says is the other guy's bad and I'm good. And then the other guy's ad comes on and says, no, the other guy's bad and I'm good. It seems kind of strange that we've kind of degenerated to this particular point. But this is the way a lot of thinking operates. We tend to think there's a certain group that is bad and another group that's good. And if the good guys take over and the bad guys get kicked out, then everything will be good. One of the statements that I made in talking about this lesson was that I think Karl Marx had a problem with that. Karl Marx basically said that the capitalists are bad and the workers are good. And if you get rid of the capitalist and put the workers into power, everything will be good. He forgot one thing. The workers are also bad. The scripture says, all sin and come short of the glory of God. So the reality of that doesn't really work out. And that was why his system or political powers that were built on Marx's thinking are doomed to fail because it isn't a big enough thinking. It's bound to come apart. And it's starting to happen right now. And it was kind of scary. I was in Croatia and Bosnia right after the war, after the Dayton Accords were signed. It was interesting the way the people were talking there. If it had gone there a long time ago, they would have said, all the bad people have now been kicked out and the good communists are taking over, so now we'll have a good country. And now the people were saying, well, the bad communists have finally gotten kicked out, and now we'll have a good democracy, and we'll have a good country. The truth of the matter is that all have sinned. You can't get rid of the bad people and just have the good people in control. You have to design a system that will deal with the evil that is in people's hearts. To me, that's one of the amazing things about the U.S. system, is that it is built on the idea of the rule of law, that there are limitations that must be put on everybody, because everybody has a certain level of evil within them. And so nobody is outside the law or is considered a good person. And Lewis saw that, I think, extremely well. And he also saw like a tightening of evil in our lives. That's one of the ways that evil can begin to hit our hearts. It can begin with just like a tightening of evil. It doesn't necessarily mean that when the good people are in control that everything will run well. As a matter of fact, sometimes directly the opposite is true. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the evil was represented by cold. And the way Lewis described it, it was always winter and never Christmas. So the whole countryside was gripped in this cold. And the thing was, when the good started coming, when Aslan started coming, the first thing that happened was that things didn't work so well. People got around with sleighs, but when Aslan came, the snow started to melt. And the sleighs didn't work so well. And a lot of times when things aren't working so well in our lives, it may well be because evil is losing its grip and good is starting to take over. Because we can design our lives to run on evil or on bad. And then all of a sudden, good starts to come in, the bad starts to break apart, and it doesn't work so well. The trains ran completely on time when Hitler was in control in Germany. But it wasn't because good was running it. Evil can be cold and very efficient. And it's also totally pervasive. It's in all of society. It's everywhere. One of the other ways that Lewis pictures evil. I did a seminar on C.S. Lewis in London and then in Oxford. The first time in London, and it was kind of neat because I also got to see some plays while I was there. And I got to see the play Les Miserables. And if you ever get a chance to see the play, see it. For me, it was like a spiritual experience. It was incredible. It took me a little while to get into it because I got seats too close to the front. And, you know, you see the spit coming out of the actors as they're singing their song. And it takes you a little while to kind of get into the play. But I got into it after a while. One of the things, it totally pictured evil, totally pervasive in the society. There weren't any places that were completely good. And we don't always do that in our movies. We tend to picture a man and a woman falling in love, kind of make it all look wonderful. And in that movie, they had a man and a woman who fell in love, but also another woman who loved the same man. They showed the pain that was in her life and the goodness that was in their lives. They didn't leave anything out. We usually make things look good by leaving some bad things out when we visualize them. The powerful thing of Les Miserables was it didn't leave anything out. There wasn't any place that wasn't tainted by pain and difficulty and suffering and evil. And after a while, it just kind of overwhelms you. You just start feeling this coming as you're watching the play, but it's true. You don't often deal with that kind of truth. Then toward the end, they began to show good, almost like a little flower that was breaking out in the middle of that. You knew the good was more powerful. The same thing in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is basically a description of the heavyweight championship of the universe. The good against the evil is the whole battle in Revelation. And the evil is represented by a gigantic beast with 10 horns and powerful dragon-like features. Good is represented by a wounded baby lamb. And it looks like it's going to be a slaughter as these two come to battle. And it is. The lamb wins. That's the incredible message of Revelation, is that the lamb wins. I saw that a little bit when I went into Croatia right after the war and saw the destruction of the war. You know, I was just overwhelmed with how destructive. Whole villages wiped out, buildings destroyed, just one after another after another. Then I went to one place where there was Steve Kurtz, a missionary from our church over there, and his wife had started a prayer meeting. And it was, well, his wife mainly, Michelle was doing it, and then there was a Muslim in there, there was a Greek Orthodox, a Catholic, all the different factions that were represented there in that prayer meeting. And they prayed together every Tuesday. And to me, it was like the lamb. I had seen the power of the beast all around. And there I saw a little tiny lamb. And it was hard to believe that the lamb was going to win. But it is. And that's one of the messages of the book of Revelation. The good is going to overcome evil, but evil is pervasive. And it's powerful. And it begins to take a hold of our hearts. It starts off at a very simple level. There are different gradations of evil in the New Testament. The basic word for sin is usually just missing the mark, falling short. Then there's wickedness and treachery, which is a much more advanced areas of evil. Lewis showed a little bit of those levels of evil. Again, one of my favorite places of looking at what a lot of what Lewis says is the Chronicles of Narnia. And here, this is right at the beginning of the Silver Chair. And Jill is about to go into Narnia. And Aslan is going to send her on a journey. And he's going to give her some guidance for the journey that she has to go on. It's kind of like the journey of life. And then there's certain things that Aslan is going to tell her what she must do. And she, first of all, asks, how will I go on this journey? And Aslan responds, I will tell you, child, said the lion. There are the signs by which I will guide you in your quest. First of all, as soon as the boy Eustace sets foot in Narnia, he will meet an old and dear friend. He must greet the friend at once. If he does, you will both have good health. Second, you must journey out of Narnia to the north, till you come to the ruined city of the ancient giants. Third, you shall find a writing on stone in that ruined city, and you must do what the writing tells you. Fourth, you will know the lost prince, if you find him, by this, that he will be the first person you have met in your travels who will ask you to do something in my name, in the name of Aslan. As the lion seemed to have finished, Jill thought she should say something, so she said, thank you very much, I see. Child, said Aslan in a gentler voice than he had yet used. Perhaps you do not quite see as well as you think. But the first step is to remember. Repeat to me in order the four signs. Jill tried and didn't quite get them right. So the lion corrected her and made her repeat them again and again till she could say them perfectly. He was very patient over this. So that when it was done, Jill plucked up courage to ask, please, how am I to get to Narnia? On my breath, said the lion. I will blow you into the west of the world as I blew Eustace. Shall I catch him in time to tell him the first sign? But I suppose it won't matter. If he sees an old friend, he's sure to go and speak to him, isn't he? You will have no time to spare, said the lion. That is why I must send you at once. Come, walk before me to the edge of the cliff. Jill remembered very well that there was no time to spare, that it was because of her fault. If I hadn't made such a fool of myself, Shrub and I would have been going together. And he had heard all the instructions as well as me, she thought. So she did as she was told. It was very alarming walking back to the edge of the cliff, especially as the lion did not walk with her, but behind her, making no noise on his soft paws. But long before she had got anywhere near the edge, the voice behind her said, stand still. In a moment I will blow. But first, remember, remember, remember the signs. Say them to yourself when you wake in the morning, and when you lie down at night, and when you wake in the middle of the night. And whatever strange things may happen to you, let nothing turn your mind from following the signs. And secondly, I give you a warning. Here on the mountain, I have spoken to you clearly. I will not often do so down in Narnia. Here on the mountain, the air is clear. Your mind is clear. As you drop down into Narnia, the air will thicken. Take great care that it does not confuse your mind. And the signs which you have learned here will not look at all as you expect them to look when you meet them there. That is why it is so important to know them by heart and pay no attention to appearances. Remember the signs, believe the signs, nothing else matters. And now, daughter of Eve, farewell. Aslan was going a little overboard and making sure that she remembered the signs, which would be her directives as she made her journey in Narnia. God does the same thing with us. He gives us signs, directions to living out this life, laws, commandments, ways of life that he teaches us to live. And the problem that we have in the beginning, the problem is not really rebellion against the signs or rebellion against what God has said, so much so as we just tend to forget. It was like we start making other things in our life more important than God. We forget the first commandment. You shall remember, I am the Lord your God who has brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. We don't realize that and we don't remember that, and we start putting other things more important than God. It's an early entrance level evil. We just forget the way things really are. And sometimes we can even be away at a conference or something like that on a mountaintop like Montreat, where the air is clear. And you see the things of God very clearly. And you're bound and determined to take them back with you. But then you go back into the normality of everyday life. And the fog is thicker there. And you don't see things as clearly there. And you aren't guided quite so well. And you forget. You forget the things of God. My wife and I, when we first became Christians, we were working through a group called Campus Crusade for Christ, and they had a training center out in California. Arrowhead Springs was up on top of a mountain. It was really odd when you left the mountain and you came down just to the city that was there, because the people in the mountains, it was a strongly Christian environment there. And then all of a sudden you left it. Everything was different. It just didn't look the same. You can kind of get caught up in that environment that you're in, and you forget. You just kind of forget what you know is true, but you forget it. And that's the entry level of evil. And then it starts moving more toward a selfishness. You first of all just forget, and then you kind of like doing things your own way. In The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Eustace was one of the children that came in from England, and he was very selfish. But one of the things about the selfishness is that it works. Most families have someone in them that is particularly selfish and maybe a little hard to deal with, but it works for them. They get the attention, they get the stuff they want, and the selfishness, after a while, works for them. And so they keep becoming more and more selfish. After we just forget the way God has said, we start doing things our own way. And after a while, then that becomes kind of a way of life. And evil begins to become stronger within us. Then not only does that become a way of life, but we actually begin to build a theology of evil, or a theology of selfishness, so that we begin to say, this is the way you're supposed to live. We have almost built a philosophy of that way of life. You see that in a lot of things that are written today. You can see that very much in what Christians might call sexual morality. There's a lot of things that are kind of like a theology of immorality or in the sexual areas that has built up a whole reason why we're supposed to fully express ourselves in however we see fit, regardless of any kind of limitations that might be put on. One of Lewis's books that he talks about people who have a selfish theology that works for them is a book called The Great Divorce. People ask me which books of Lewis to maybe start reading. I'd suggest maybe start reading with Screwtape Letter. It's a fairly easy to read one. It gives you an idea of how Lewis works and operates. Then maybe The Chronicles of Narnia. Even if you're old, you read children's stories when you're young, and then you read them when you start getting a little older, and then you read them. I'm 55 now. You start reading them at my age again, and you keep reading them, because Lewis rather beautifully wrote a book later in his life called Experiment and Criticism, which was basically a book on how to read a book. It was a literary kind of classic. In there, he was saying the tales of the marvelous, which is what he called children's stories, the tales of the marvelous have been relegated to children, much like certain types of furniture get relegated to the child's room. but it's not necessarily because of any innate thing in the furniture. It just sort of happens to end up there. He said the same things have happened to the Tales of the Marvelous. But the children's fairy tales are well worth reading again. And then later on, again, you can read the Chronicles of Narnia and pick up a whole new level of truth in them. This book, The Great Divorce, would probably be another one to read fairly early with understanding with what Lewis is saying. This is a book about a busload of people from hell. There's sort of a bus gathered together in hell, and the people are given a chance to go to the edge of heaven. And so some people get on the bus, and they go up this, what looks like a large chasm, and they come up into heaven. And people from heaven come out to meet them and try to talk them into staying. Lewis does some beautiful symbolism there. The people from hell are phantom people. They are like smoke, wisps of smoke. You can barely see them. Lewis believes that evil sort of consumes a person until they become hardly anything left of them. And the people from heaven were solid people, people who are the way they appear. I've conducted quite a few funerals, and I don't think the people really understand it, but probably the most complimentary description I ever give of someone is they were a solid person. They were someone who wasn't all image, but they were who they appeared to be. Sometimes they didn't always look real proper for Christians, but they were solid, and they were real, and they were real in their relationship and their walk with God. And the thing about these people who come up from hell, they've come to the edge of heaven, the people from heaven try to talk them into staying, but the people from hell have built up a real good theology of evil, and they can't break through. I think there's only a couple of them on the whole busload who come up from hell who stay in heaven. And really, I think there's a lot of truth in that. A lot of people think they want to go to heaven. I did this little radio show back in Silva. We've talked about it a couple of times. I said, how many of you really want to go to heaven? I mean, the basic advantage of heaven is that there you get to be with the Lord Jesus Christ all the time. You get to be with him directly and completely. You get to be with all these other people who love Jesus in a powerful and a unique way. Would that be heaven for a lot of you? Would you really want to go somewhere where you have a chance to be able to walk with God all the time? Would you really want to be somewhere where all the other people there are the same kind of people? If you don't want to go there, if you want to go somewhere where you have complete freedom to express your own desires, your own wishes, live out your life in exactly the way that you want to do, God has a place for you to be able to go and do that too. We call that place hell. You get to go there with all the other people, and you get to live out the reality of their existence. The way Lewis described hell was, it was kind of like a constantly expanding place. Because in hell, you could just imagine a house. It would come true, and so you could start to live in it. But the only thing happened was someone else would then come along and imagine a house near yours. And after a while, you wouldn't get along. So you would go out somewhere else and imagine another house and would live out there. Then other people would come out to there and imagine a house close by, and you couldn't get along with them either. So you kept moving outward, away from each other. Heaven would be more of a place where it goes the other way. Instead of moving away from each other, you come together toward each other. I'll read a little bit. There's one person who came up to heaven, and the people who met them in heaven were people that they knew in their life here. And one of them was the president of the Theological Society in hell. And he had come up to heaven, and one of the people that knew him before had come to meet him and was trying to talk him into staying. I'll give you just a little bit of their conversation so you begin to get a sense of what it's like. This is the spirit of the person who's come from heaven speaking, first of all. He says, I am not trying to make any point, said the spirit. I am telling you to repent and believe. But my dear boy, I believe already. We may not be perfectly agreed, but you will have completely misjudged me if you do not realize that my religion is a very real and a very precious thing to me. Very well, said the other, as if changing his plan. Will you believe in me? In what sense? Will you come with me to the mountains? It will hurt at first until your feet are hardened. Reality is harsh to the feet of shadows. But will you come? Well, that is the plan. I am perfectly ready to consider it. But of course, I would require some assurances. I should want a guarantee that you are taking me to a place where I shall find a wider sphere of usefulness, a scope for the talents that God has given me, and an atmosphere of free inquiry. In short, all that one means by civilization and or the spiritual life. No, said the spirit, I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of usefulness, you're not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land not of questions, but of answers, and you shall see the face of God. How about we just all interpret those beautiful words in our own way? For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? Prove all things. To travel hopefully is better than to arrive. If that were true, and known to be true, how could anyone travel hopefully? There would be nothing to hope for. But you must feel yourself that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy. What is more soul-destroying than stagnation? And continues, they go on battering it back and forth. Hopefully you might pick it up and read it. It's a real interesting dialogue as the theologian is dealing with the spirit who's coming down from heaven. And he ends up going back to hell. He has a paper to deliver back in hell the next week. And the paper is on what might have happened had Jesus' life not been cut short. He only lived to be 33. And imagine what great things he might have been able to accomplish had he lived much longer. He felt that paper was important enough that he needed to go back to hell. That was another level of evil or wickedness, where we actually build a theology that allows our evil to work. And another kind of level that Lewis talks about getting to is the one that Edmund came to in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He called it a treachery or betrayal. And there gets to be a point where you literally begin to belong to evil. Lewis talks about it in the way he describes some of his characters, and Edmund is probably the clearest one, but you have to look over a long way. If you happen to have read a book by Scott Peck called The People of the Lie, he dealt with the same idea. There begins to become a point where evil is in control of us. It's almost like that we have dissolved away. Even when we're totally selfish and we've built our theology around selfishness, it's our theology. But there actually gets to be a point where we leave even that behind because we leave ourselves behind. And we become what Scott Peck calls people of the lie. Usually those people are very nice people, but they're people who practically don't see anything else but themselves. Everything else around them is like an extension of who they are. It might be close to what Paul calls a reprobate mind, a person who doesn't even see the reality of things beyond themselves. Even the people that are there in their lives, they use only for themselves. Sometimes they have children. It's unfortunate because they use their children for themselves, and it's about as battering, as damaging as anything that can be. You know, some of these people look very proper, but it's almost like there's nothing left inside of them. I think I've known a few people like that, and they would be very socially acceptable people usually, but they don't run their lives on their heart at all, or any even reality of other people. They run on rules, and that's about all they have. There are certain ways to do things. It doesn't matter what the other people around you think or feel. They have almost no empathy. And Scott Peck, what he was experimenting with in The People of the Lie was the only way to deal with those people is like a possession, where evil possesses the people. He talked about demon possession and trying to cast out the evil that is there in their life. It's almost like something has to break through. In a way, if a child has been raised by a person like that, they become so damaged that it's like God has to break in a powerful way, almost let them grow up again with God being their parent. It's a level of evil that is very terrible, very powerful thing. When evil takes those steps and gets a hold of us. There's also the cases that Lewis talks about where we go from very good to evil. We've been given a very good or a precious gift, and we turn it almost immediately to start using it for ourselves. I think sometimes that happens with child abuse, sexual abuse with children. You're given a tremendous, precious gift when a child loves you. And you can use that in a very terrible way for yourself. You can easily turn things that are very good and very precious to something that's very bad. That happened with Lucy. She was tempted to do that in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where she's probably the best character in Lewis's books. She was able to see into the future. She was able to see back into England, and she was able to see how her friends were talking about her. They weren't talking about her in a very nice way. Immediately, she was given this gift of being able to see the total discernment of her friends. Immediately, she said, well, if that's the way they're going to treat me, they don't have to worry about my being their friend any longer. And just then, Aslan growled behind her. It was almost like if you're given a precious gift like that, you have to bring it under the lordship of Jesus Christ, or you're in trouble. It's a scary thing to be a minister, particularly if you're a good one. It's a scary thing to be given that kind of responsibility, because it can be turned to be used badly. I don't care what kind of spiritual gift you have. If you have the gift of tongues, if you have the gift of teaching, the gift of preaching, the gift of evangelism, the gift of administration, if you start using it for yourself, it can be used badly. I think we have a lot of problem with that in today's church. we have the ability of being able to promote ourselves into high positions. It was very important, that parable that Jesus taught about when you go to a banquet, you seek out the lesser seat and only go to the head table if you're asked and moved to the head table. Our aim today is often, if we've got a little bit of ability, is if we sell it well enough to be able to get promoted to the head table right away. Well, a lot of times we're promoted and we're not really ready to deal with things. Our walk with God isn't at a position where we're able to handle the gifts that have been given to us, and we end up perverting, turning them around for our own good. We end up building cathedrals in our own name. We end up raising money for ourselves. We start using the things very badly that God has given us. And that was another level that Lewis worked with evil, where not only does it, sometimes it can be just that binding that starts slowly but then just sort of pulls you into itself. And sometimes it can be a turning of a good gift like that. And then there are other times when it's just directly spiritual evil. There are some people that just completely go over to the devil's side. There's such a thing as the devil. There's such a thing as people that follow him. And they aren't ugly. You know, the one person that was like that was Jadis, in the magician's nephew. She became the White Witch then. The White Witch and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that began to have control over all of Narnia. And Uncle Andrew, who was Diggory's uncle and an older man, he always referred to Jadis as a dim fine woman. She was very pretty, very attractive, very alluring, someone that would easily draw you into him. That's the way Lewis pictured perfect evil, or complete evil, was it was very beautiful, very drawing, very winning. We always forget that Satan was the most beautiful of God's creatures, probably still is. So the personification of evil is the greatest beauty that was there in our world. One kind of a closing thing you always want to remember when you talk about evil, Lewis got it from Paul, when sin increases, grace increases all the more. I remember one time in my life, this is several years ago, about almost 20 years ago now, I read a book by William Stringfellow called An Ethic for Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land. And it was a book that was real hard for me to read, to understand when I first read it, mainly because of the words. I'm used to theologians' words. I'm somewhat used to literary people's words. I studied engineering, so I'm somewhat used to engineers' words. But William Stringfellow was a lawyer, and I wasn't used to lawyer words. It took me about 3 chapters to kind of get into what he was talking about. But then one of the things I started feeling after I read him for a while was the totality of evil in the world that we live in, and also that's in my own heart. It was like there was no place that you could go away from evil, even in the church. When I welcome people to my church in Silva, I said, we welcome you to a community of sinners. If you look around, you'll find fault with each one of us, especially with the minister, because you see him better. But our purpose isn't to point you to ourselves, but to point you to Jesus Christ, because it's in him that we find forgiveness. And so even in the church, we have evil. In our own lives, we have evil. So I started seeing the reality of that. You know, sometimes we always say, oh yeah, that's true. But every once in a while, the reality of that starts hitting us, or hitting me. And I went into kind of like a downward spiral. A spiral of depression. My grandparents immigrated from Slovenia and Croatia, and my uncle says the Slovenians are morose people. We dance the polka and drink beer on weekends to kind of kill the morose feelings that we have the rest of the week. So I can easily go into a moroseness, and I went into one for about 2 or 3 weeks, and it felt like everything in the world was taken away from me. It really wasn't, but it felt like it. And I got down to the bottom of the spiral, and the only thing left was I was God's child. And I realized I would always be God's child. I'll be God's child if the world falls apart. I'll be God's child when I die. I'll be God's child for all eternity. Nothing will ever take that away. It was like I could see the abounding of sin, but then that started the abounding of grace, because I'm God's child strictly by grace. And that will never go away from me. Where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. Never want to go too far into the reality of evil without beginning to catch the reality of good. One last reading. Jadis, the White Witch, was ready to kill Edmund, and Aslan said, no, I'll die in his place. And so she put him on the table, bound him up, and killed him. And he died on the table of the law. And then the children went through a terrible night. It was 2 of the girls of the children that were there, sat with them all night. And then they saw mice coming. There were Narnian mice, talking mice, and they gnawed away the ropes. And he was first of all freed in that way. And then as the sun came up, this is what then happened. The rising of the sun made everything look so different. All the colors and the shadows were changed, that for a moment they didn't seem the important thing. Then they did. The stone tablet was broken into 2 pieces by a great crack that ran down it from end to end. And there was no Aslan. Oh, Oh, cried the girls, rushing back to the table. It's too bad, sobbed Lucy. They might have left the body alone. Who's done it? Cried Susan. What does it mean? Is it more magic? Yes, said a great voice behind their back. It's more magic. They looked around, and there, shining in the sunshine, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, for apparently it had grown again, stood Aslan himself. Oh, Aslan, cried both children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. You aren't dead then, are you, dear Aslan, said Lucy. Not now, said Aslan. You're not a... Susan, she couldn't bring herself to say the word ghost. Aslan stooped down his golden head and licked her forehead. The warmth of his breath and the rich sort of smell that seemed to hang over her, about his hair, came all over her. Do I look it, he said. Oh, you're real, you're real. Oh, Aslan, cried Lucy. Both girls flung themselves upon him and covered him with kisses. But what does it all mean, asked Susan, when they were somewhat calmer. It means, said Aslan, that though the witch knew the deep magic, there was a deeper magic still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back, into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had been committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack, and death itself would start working backwards. And then later on, they have a journey to go on. This little description of that journey. We have a long journey to go. You must ride with me. And he crouched down, and the children climbed onto his warm, golden back. And Susan sat first holding on tightly to his mane. And Lucy sat behind holding on tightly to Susan. And with a great heave, he rose underneath them, and then shot off faster than any horse could go, downhill and into the thick of the forest. That ride was perhaps the most wonderful thing that happened to them in Narnia. Have you ever had a gallop on a horse? Think of that. Then take away the heavy noise of the hooves and the jingle of the harnesses, and imagine instead the most noiseless padding of the great paws. Then imagine instead of the black or gray chestnut back of the horse, the softness of golden fur and the mane flying back in the wind. And then imagine you are going about twice as fast as the fastest racehorse. But this is a mount that doesn't need to be guided and never grows tired. He rushes on and on, never missing his footing, never hesitating, treading his way with perfect skill between tree trunks, jumping over bush and briar and smaller streams, wading the larger, swimming the largest of all. And you are riding not on a road or in a park or even down the downs, but right across Narnia, in spring down solemn avenues of beech and across sunny glades of oak, through wild orchards of white snow-covered cherry trees, past roaring waterfalls and mossy rocks and echoing caverns, up windy slopes light with rushes and across the shoulders of heathery mountains and long giddy ridges, and down, down, down again into wild valleys, into acres of blue flowers. This is the ride that they had through Narnia after Aslan had come back to life and they got on him. I remember Earl Palmer, who's a real Lewis lover and a good friend of mine and a great teacher of Lewis, and he talks about when his kids would wake up at night and having nightmares, as all kids do after a while. Scary things that come in the dark. Usually we try to tell them that no, those things don't exist. What Earl did instead, he said, sooner or later, scary things in the dark do exist. When we get older, we do have to face scary things. And so what he told the kids was, he said, imagine yourself riding on Aslan's back. You've heard all about Aslan. Imagine what it's like on his back. Your bed is like his back. All those bad things that are there in the room, look down at how small and insignificant they are compared to Aslan. And the kids knew that Aslan was God. And that's kind of the way our lives are as we ride through our world, the great difficulties that are out there. We ride through them on God's back. What things can overwhelm us when we're riding on Aslan's back? There's a little poem. C.S. Lewis, most of his friends call him Jack. His name was Clive Staples Lewis, so it's no wonder they called him C.S. Lewis. He didn't want to be Clive Staples, so one day he walked into his house and said, I'm Jack. And so his family, all his friends from then on, called him Jack. So that's where the name Jack comes from. And there's a little poem that one of his friends wrote after he died, and it said, there was a crack, and there was Jack, riding on Aslan's back. And that was the picture they thought he would have when he'd be able to go to heaven.